Today I'm going to introduce Tom. You guys know him because he's been here on and off for, boy, since the beginning of Friends Church. He's been a part of this. And Tom, if you don't know him, this guy's had a journey. He's seen parts of life that, man, he's been all over the place. He's seen some hard times. He's seen some amazing times. He built probably one of the biggest churches in all of Calgary. He's also probably had some, well, he's going to tell you, he's had some rough times. What I find with people, though, is people who have their kind of their stuff all figured out, you know, the people who have everything, you know, under control and nothing bad's ever happened to them, I don't really want to listen to them because they're kind of boring, right? Basically, I'm blessed, you're not, so what can you learn? Tom has an ability, though, to take all of his life, good, bad, ugly, otherwise, and find learning in it. So I said, Tom, would you be open this summer just to kind of give us your story? We call it a founding story. We only get to tell it once. Most of you haven't heard Tom's founding story. And in it and through it, I want you guys to look for two things. Look for your story and his story, because you're going to hear some of it. It's not the same. Everyone's got a different story, but you're going to hear parts of your story and his. And then Tom, as kind of a guy who's worked in spirituality his whole life, he has a way of looking at life that helps you grow spiritually. So I want you to just be open to that today. Is that fair? Let's give him a big round of applause, okay?
Good morning, everybody. It is good to be here today, and that's a little intimidating kind of intro. You get to tell it once. You get one shot at this. You got to take 62 years. Yes, I'm 62. And you got to kind of condense it into a 30-minute presentation that will somehow make sense, right? So let me just say that I'm an egotistical, proud, cheating drunk. Is that all right? Okay. That's the bad news. And I still struggle with all of those. So I'm not here to suggest to you or to put out there that perfection is the way to go. Because the Christian journey, if we know anything about it from any sense, the way up is down. And there's many. I've played with 100 titles for today. I've thought of falling upward. That would be plagiaristic. I've thought of meeting Jesus again for the very first time. That's plagiaristic. So I thought of this one here: the untidy memoirs of an imperfect pilgrim. And so the idea of memoirs is great, by the way, because they're my memories, and you can't say whether it happened or not. Right? It's not autobiographical. It's not trying to be factual. I feel like the first native chief that sat down at the beginning of his story, and he said, I'm going to tell you a story, and it's true. I'm not sure if it happened or not, but it's true. And so a lot of what happens in life to us, and this is, as I've reflected on this over the last couple of weeks, has been really... it's been really interesting to extrapolate some of the learnings. And what is it at the very foundation of who I desire to become and my formative piece that is worthy or worth communicating? All right, and that's been part of the struggle. So let me begin by saying one of the influences in my journey is Thomas Merton. And Thomas Merton was he died in 1968. He was a Catholic monk, and he talked a lot. And I've got a quote of his right at the beginning here. Along the journey to God, the self that begins is not the self that arrives. At the outset, our self is who we thought ourselves to be. This self dies along the way until, in the end, no one is left. This no one is our true self. I deeply believe that the idea of story or narrative That a lot of times in a pilgrim's progress, you feel like you're going backwards. Am I the only one who's kind of done that? And it's not two steps forward, one step backward. A lot of times it's one step forward, eight steps backwards. And you really feel like, man, I blew this. I really messed this up. Kind of, where's the learning? And the recovery takes longer than you think it's going to take, you know? So it's a really interesting piece around that. A word jumped out to me as I was researching. So this is completely different from my story. If I was to describe God today, the one word that I would use to describe God is ineffable. I love that word. It's just a very cool word. And God is ineffable basically means that we are incapable of being expressed in words. Does that compute, everybody? In trying to describe God, we are very limited in language, right? So what we do is we use anthropomorphic language, we use metaphor, we use all kinds of stuff to try to describe something. And in the end, it's ineffable. God is beyond words, and that's why the experience of God is each and every person's experience of God is very unique. And I think for me, I grew up with kind of this supernatural, powerful image of God that was out there somewhere. And once in a while intervened in life, and I wasn't sure why he intervened or when he intervened, and I wasn't sure if I believed some of the interventions that I heard about in the testimonies, right? And there were some amazing testimonies. And it was often the same people that would testify over and over. And I was like, oh, okay, so that's starting to be unbelievable. In the truest sense of the word, unbelievable. And so this supernatural God, it was difficult to try to get a handle on that. And so one of the titles I thought of today was calling this the House of Cards. And I was going to build a house of cards until I figured to build a house of cards is really difficult. Like, it's really hard. I spent some time trying to build a house of cards and I thought I'd give up. But our theology is a lot like that. Right? A theology is we sometimes, I have built this house of cards. And that becomes very precarious. And so one tries to protect this house of cards that you've invested a lot in. Right? Because, you know, any slight, kind of tip or one card that goes, the whole house, could go down. And so, that's been part of my journey is to really understand that. A couple of important themes that I see that pop up for me. And the way of telling story. Let me just back up one step. The way of telling story. I was raised in England. I'm the oldest of five. I have two brothers. I have two half-sisters. Both of my parents were married three times each. And my mom gave up on men after the third one, and my dad actually ended up in a very happy relationship that when he was older, he had two kids with my stepmom, who was born the same day I was born, same day, same year, same month. And so that was always interesting, calling her mom. You know, it just didn't work really well. And so it was interesting. My dad was a prof at university, and that was significant because academia was really important. So some of you here you've been raised by dads that are kind of fix-it dads. Anybody got a fix-it dad? He can fix anything. And you're that kind of guy, right? He's got tools and he passes those tools on to you, right? My dad couldn't hang a picture if his life depended on it. He was not that guy. He had four master's degrees. All right? And he had the highest degree you can get in music, just in addition to the rest of that. And my grandmother used to say, why don't you be like your dad? And I'm going, I quit. Not happening. So oftentimes when that road's taken, what can happen, and it did for me, is I found another. I found it in sports. I was quite athletic growing up, played soccer. And so that was more, my piece. And you know, in those formative days, my dad was a conductor of choral music, and choral music and Led Zeppelin don't mix well. Just saying. And so I was really trying to find my own way with that. My mom was a nurse, and they would fight fairly frequently, and the number one fight they would have, because most couples have one fight that's an ongoing issue for all couples. You all have one, and don't look at me like I don't. All the wives are looking at the husband going, see, I knew that. there's one fight, and the one fight my parents would have was me. Right? They would always fight about how to raise me. And I was your typical, and this is what the term we use, problem child. Yeah, anybody got one of those? I think most families, God gives them at least one problem child just so they don't write another book about parenting. So I think that's helpful. And when my parents split up when I was about 12, my mom left, she came to Canada. I thought in my 12-year-old brain, that must be my fault, right? So very formative in terms of, yeah, kind of what happened there. And didn't, you know, because my dad was busy doing what most dads are doing in the 30s and 40s, kind of making a career, didn't have as much of a relationship with my dad, and really struggled in terms of what to do, where to go. And in the latter part of my kind of time spent with my dad in England, it was quite traumatic. That was when I was about 12, 13, when I started using drugs, started drinking, smoking, all that kind of stuff. And my dad just didn't know what to do. And so he called my mom and said, look, can you handle him? And so I came to Canada when I was 15. And so I was here, went to high school in Montreal, and I was in grade 11, and my mom had chosen to go back to England because my other two brothers were not getting along with the stepmom, so she went back. And I had a choice at that point, in grade 11, whether to stay here or go back to England, and I chose to stay. And so would work an evening shift and was going to high school at the same time. And in some ways, those are really formative pieces, right? And continued to use a fair bit of drugs, and that kind of increased incrementally and then exponentially to the point when I was 19, I ended up in a drug recovery home in Montreal called Sparrow, which is the Latin word for hope. And I went to rehab there, and it was one of those, we were up on a farm, and afterwards, after the 9 months in treatment, I was invited to stay as one of the staff workers, which I did for the next couple of years. And it was in that season of sobriety, and that was 42 years ago, so I've been sober 42 years from drugs and alcohol. But as any addict knows, we're brilliant at switching addictions. Right, so I can say I've been sober, but food is a good addiction, you know. So I don't know about you, but the food in the fridge talks to me. I don't know if it talks to you, but it does to me, especially if it's ice cream, right? And apparently, ice cream is not on Weight Watchers. Just saying. I just discovered that the other day because I'm going to Weight Watchers now, and so I'm watching my weight now. I watch it. It's really fascinating to watch, and so those addictions can really take you out, and as we can switch them, et cetera. But lots of learning in that process, and so one of the pieces that I gained when I was in rehab was the whole idea of being honest about yourself. And I think I've told this here before, but I'll share it because it's a big part of my journey. I was in rehab for about 3 months, and they had a session, and this was back in, you gotta remember, this is in the 70s. So we were not very, savvy around how we did recovery. It was based on kind of gestalt reality therapy, which is, I would compare that to doing surgery with a chainsaw. It was very bloody, but it got the job done kind of deal. And so one of the things they said, I'm sitting in therapy, and they said, one of the counselors said to me, why are you here? I said, because I'm a drug addict. Duh. Why else would you be here? You know, this is not like a holiday camp. This is not Club Med. This is a rehab. And I'm thinking, that's a really dumb question. He said, no. He says, well, you're not using drugs now the last couple of months. He says, so why are you still here? I said, and this was an honest response. I said, I don't know. And so he then says to me, he says, well, tell me how you feel. And I said, I'm fine. He said, tell me how you really feel. And I said, I'm really fine. And he said, you're lying. And I go, I didn't know that, you know. So he said, go grab a chair. So the chair session, these were the rules on the chair. You sat in the chair, you couldn't eat and you couldn't sleep and you couldn't smoke, which was a big issue. And so you had to sit there. And the only rule to get off the chair was get honest. Was it? So I got on the chair, I think it was at 7 o'clock in the evening. And it was well into the morning. We're talking 5, 6 o'clock in the morning when I finally got honest. And here's what happened. I'd been up all night. They'd been talking to me, basically wearing you down. And, I had a pretty bad potty mouth and I was, a bit edgy. So, you know, they're trying to break you down and my defenses are up big time. And so at the end of this kind of chair session, Barry Jones walks in and he was a guy that I knew from the street. And he came into the room, true story, came into the room, stood behind my chair, put his arms around me and held me. And he whispers in my ear, he said, it's pretty lonely out there, isn't it, Tom? Instantly, I felt something. And for the first time in about 7 years, I felt something. And the emotion came out. I couldn't stop the emotion. The aloneness. My parents' divorce. It wasn't all the bad stuff I'd done in dealing and stealing and all that stuff. It was the fact that I felt alone. That moment, I got honest. And I learned in that moment how to get honest and how to get in touch with my heart. Now, did I always stay in touch with my heart? Let me just say it this way. I went back on the chair numerous times through recovery because I lost connection with my heart, right? And by the end of recovery, I got it. It was like, okay, this life is really about living consciously. And so a couple of things came out of this that... that are themes through the spiritual journey. Am I? Oh, thanks, buddy. What a nice guy. Somebody asked me the other day, Jeff, after we played, they said, tell me about Jeff. I said, he's just one of the nicest guys I know. He's just nice. You're all jealous now, aren't you? So, a couple of themes. Spirituality teaches us about letting go of who you don't, what you don't need and who you are not. Spirituality teaches us to let go of what we don't need and who we're not. All right? Meister Eckhart said it this way. We come into being and non-being all in the same moment. By the way, if you read a lot of Meister Eckhart, it doesn't get any easier than that with him. He's a mystic. In other words, as we develop our personality, right, as we develop that sense of being of who the false self that we put out there, Merton calls, right? Because let's face it, John Vanier said this, we're not so much human beings seeking a spiritual experience, rather we are spiritual beings. And I'll get to that in a bit. But in our pursuit of God, it betrays the fact that we see God as out there because I'm pursuing God, and our language tells us that we see God as a supernatural being out there somewhere. So I was lost, now I'm found. As though God lost you. It's like, where is that tinker? You know? Like, you can't get lost. It's impossible to get. How do you get lost from a God who's everywhere? Doesn't make sense, because wherever you go, God's already there. Okay, I'm hiding from God, and when I go to hide in my hiding place, God is the hiding place. It's hard to do that. But in our language, we talk about God that way, as though he's super. And I'm going to suggest that a panentheistic way of seeing God, right? Pan being everything, en in, and theism God, God in everything. He is not everything, but he's in everything, is maybe a better way of seeing God than out there. That God is here, and we are in God, and God is in us, and in him we live and move and have our being, as the poets say. And that's where that has led me to, understanding God in that way. So Merton puts it this way. Let me just read this to you, because this, in essence, sums up a lot of the journey that I have experienced. Merton doesn't question the reality and importance of the empirical self. We would call it personality or ego. We must deeply respect our whole person, right? The quadrinity of who we are, right? Mind, body, soul, and emotions, right? All of us. Including the day-by-day realities of life and the self that is formed by them, right? So we are formed and shaped by those experiences that we go through, okay? What Merton does say, however, is that when the relative identity of ego is taken to be my deepest and only identity, right? In other words, when I'm just the sum total of my relationships and what I've accomplished and what I have acquired, when that defines me, that becomes my identity, right? And our language tells us that's my car, these are my kids, this is my family, these are my friends, and I'm attached to all of those things, and I am some composite of all of that, right? That's what Merton's referring to then, about this collective that creates the sense of identity, right? And when I am thought to be nothing but the sum total of all my relationships, then when I cling to this self and make it the center around which and for which I live, I then make my empirical identity into the false self. We got that? See, because Jesus says some pretty nasty stuff in Scripture. Like, sometimes he's just downright mean. True. He goes, you got to die to yourself. Like, who says that? Right? I mean, really, it's just a mean thing to say. You got to die to yourself. What he's saying there, I think, is that he's saying that empirical self is what you need to die to, because my own self then, and I love this point, my own self then becomes the obstacle to realizing my true self. Here's the deal. I'm in my own way. And to get me out of my way, that's hard. Because I don't know about you, but I can screw my life up faster than anybody else. Hello? Oh, hello? Okay, saints. See, here's the piece. And when we don't learn those lessons, right? The Creator has a wonderful way of bringing us back to them. Have you ever kind of gone through a lesson with a friend or a job or you know, kid or something like that, and then you come back and you pass that way again, and it feels like, oh, boy, I've done this one before, right? I've messed this one up before, right? And then you go, oh, maybe I didn't get it last time. And that false self, that ego, so we have a saying in our culture that says ego is, hello? Ego is blind. Hello? Never heard that? Well, okay. Because I can't see me. Right? I can't. I didn't know I was such a bad driver till I got married. Who knew? I thought there was just a lot of idiots out there. Right? So I don't see that, and that's why we need each other. We need relationships. We need honesty with each other to someone to say, hey, Tom, that's offside. That behavior, that way of being, it's just like, really? Is that who you want to be? I'm going, well, no. Well, you're just in your ego. And it's so hard, especially if it's in the moment, it's really hard to hear that. Because that's just me being me. It's actually me being the false self that gets in the way, right? And I would, can I suggest that most marital conflict is because of the false self? Because the false self has to protect itself and go, I'm right. Because most of our arguments are basically two words, I'm right. Right? And then your partner says, no, I'm right. And then it doesn't matter what you're right about. It's just that we just continue to up the ante because I'm right. Hello? Hello, married couples? Anybody here? Get that? Yeah, I'm right. No, I'm right. No, I'm right. You know, and we go on and on because I'm right. Damn it, I'm right. You know, and that ego gets in our way. And my ego, oh my goodness, gets in the way. And can take me out, can take me out, can take me out. Now, there is a psychology of spirituality that needs to be addressed in any story. And it's important that we own it. So let me read this. As the brain processes sensory experiences, we naturally look for patterns and then seek out meaning in those patterns. And the phenomenon known as cognitive dissonance shows that once we believe in something, we will try to explain away anything that conflicts with it. Calvin did that. Luther did that. Bell, McLaren, Borg, Jarvis, Clausen, Oprah. We all do it. Right? In other words, our formative years from 0 to 12 fashion us. Classic case. John Calvin grew up as a very insecure young man when he wrote his treatise at the age of 16 that created tulip theology that defined a lot of Western thought around theology. He comes up with a doctrine called eternal security. Is it any wonder that someone who's desperately insecure wants to find security? In other words, the theology reflects his own brokenness. But when it's unconscious and we don't see that, right, we think that that's how God is. And then we protect it. Right? And doing a paradigm shift from a theological perspective, right, to get any of us in this room to shift how we see God or how we see spirit or how we see the universe, because we've made sense of it and we've got this pattern, right? And so now someone's saying, okay, we need to shift. That paradigm shift is really hard to make. And if you don't think it is, invite a couple of people from, you know, Westboro Baptist or a couple of Mormons over or a couple of J-Dubs over, you know, and have a con. And I've done it just for sport. You know, you can lay out lexicons and you can lay out scriptures and you can show it to them and I don't see it because it doesn't fit their paradigm. Right? And so paradigms are very powerful and we do tend to protect them. And I love that passage in Corinthians where it says, when I was a child, I thought like a child. And I reasoned as a child. But when I grew up, I put childish ways behind me. Remember I said at the beginning, spirituality is learning to let go? And oftentimes we don't. I haven't. And I can, it's like I ask myself this question a lot. How old do I feel in this moment? Right? And when I catch myself, it's like, oh, I feel about 8. Awesome. Like I'm 62 and I got an 8-year-old running my life. It's really cool. Yeah, but 8-year-olds don't make great choices, right? They make 8-year-old choices. You see? So that's why as we mature, that's why the spiritual journey is about letting go of those childish ways. Now, that's different from being childlike, by the way. childish and childlike. One's about innocence, the other one's about behavior, right? About a way of thinking. And so as an adult, as we begin to think differently, see life differently, behave in a way that reflects our adult life. One of the things that growing up in the family that I did, created for my mom, let me describe my mom to you. she, some moms are like awesome moms. And they are very maternal. Have you heard the word maternal? Very, like, it's instinctive. How many, like, great moms we got here? Who's a great mom? Yeah, a bunch of great moms. Now, if I said this, how many of you in here, like, really suck at being a mom? That you wouldn't be kind of owning that, right? Only your kids can say that in retrospect after you're dead, right? So, I'm going to say it about my mom. Whatever the maternal gene was, she just didn't get a lot of it. And I understand it. Like, she was raised in an alcoholic home, and she had two brothers that were quite mean to her. And she's got three sons and then three husbands. So there's a theme going on there. And didn't do well in her relationship with men, right? And so that sense of affection, that sense of nurture was just missing. And so for me, I was always looking for love. I was looking to be loved. I was looking to belong, looking to connect. And the first time that I walked into an AA meeting, true story, walk in an AA meeting, and they go around the room and they go, "Hi, my name's so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic." And everybody then said, "Hi," called them by their name. And one of my lifelong friends, Bob, was there. He was chairing the meeting. And he started, and he went all the way around the room. And I was the last one, and it was my first AA meeting. And I was still trying to figure out if I was an alcoholic or not. Although I did pass the test on AA, the 20 questions. It's the only test I ever got 20 out of 20 on. So there was an indication there might be a problem. And got round to me, and I said, "Hi, my name's Tom." And I almost choked on the words, but I said, "I'm an alcoholic." And everybody said, "Hi, Tom." And in that moment, there was this certain sense of, hey, I'm home. I'm with people. The only thing you got to do to belong to AA is just admit that you need help, which is kind of cool. It's a pretty low bar. I mean, it's not exactly high. But, you know, in one sense, it's like I'm in, you know. And that sense of belonging was very powerful in recovery, right? And it's interesting that in that context of rehab, the level of honesty, because we're all broken. And it always mystified me later when I became a Christian and was part of, you know, organized Christianity, that was somewhat missing. There was always a disconnect for me in that. The level of dishonesty in this community is so easy. Because what we do is we come and we want people to like us, so the false self shows up rather than the real self. See, because if I connect with you as a real person and with all of my stuff, right? And so, because if you're actually going to love me, you got to love all of me. If I'm going to love you, I'm going to love all of you. Right? And all of us, all of me, has a shadow side. And we all have a good side. And so you got to, and that's the beautiful thing about discovering God's love, is that he loves all of you. The problem is, I didn't love all of me. I didn't like my shadow side. That shadow side can take me out. That shadow side could really hurt and damage me. And so my pursuit was really one of love. And when I read 1 Corinthians 13, love is patient, love is kind. It was like, oh, there, you can see and see what love is. I'm going to skip over a couple of slides. Go to Problems Arise, if you would. So, you know, I went to Bible school after kind of my conversion experience. And in Bible school, we built this house of cards. Now, you go to college and you get just enough time to get indoctrinated, not enough time to get educated. Just saying. And so we get there and I'm building this house of cards, but some of the cards didn't fit. And I got a deck of cards. And in a deck of cards, you may not bump into them very often, but there are jokers in here. And what happened is that as I started to build, I'm going, man, I found some real jokers in just some unbelievable stuff that just didn't make sense. But when you're part of a denomination, right, you have to sign off on certain things. And so the Bible was read, if you like, as a constitution with kind of this legal, loyally way of looking at it. And it was, here was the doctrine. It's inerrant, it's inspired, because the Bible says it's inspired. And that means it's inerrant. That means it's, you know, perfect and everything, and it's from God, and it's authoritative. And so when you start there, then you build this house of cards based on that. Well, then it's literal too, right? So I'm going, okay, so now you got hell. And I don't know about you, but that was always a problem for me. This idea that God would burn you, like, for a long time. And I've asked many dads, how long could you hold a lighter under your child's hand? And the answer I've always got is, I can't. And if you can't, right, as a mere mortal, how could God do that when he's more loving than you'll ever be? He can't. So if the Bible's literal, well, boom, that card goes, and the whole house comes down. So now I'm patching it together. It's like, I got this deck of cards, and I got a bunch of jokers in there, and it's like, it just doesn't work anymore. Anybody identify with that? And basically all you're left with is a kind of deck of cards, and you kind of go, reshuffle them. Let's try this again, you know? Okay, let's give this another whirl, you know? Like, let's try this again. And then there's some sleight of hands, and there's a whole bunch of card tricks that you could do if you were a magician, which I'm not about to do. But guess what? It's felt like people have done that to me with the scriptures, right? And so when that started to crumble for me, the whole house went down. And all I'm left with is this kind of jumbled 52 card pickup, and it just wasn't working. Because my experience of God is that God was always loving. So if the Bible's not literal, what is it? And I remember having coffee with Jeff about 4 or 5 years ago, Jeff. Maybe it's longer than that, 7 or 8 years ago. And Jeff said to me, well, maybe the Bible's more than literal. I thought, that was a clever trick. How did you do that? And sure enough, that was a place that I began to understand the Bible in a different way. And I began to look at things differently. Let me just go back to one quick scripture, and I'll share this. So go back to the second part of the parable of the prodigal son. I'm going to end here because I'm getting timed out here. I've got 2 seconds to read this. So he returned home to his father. This is the prodigal son. And while he was still a long way off, his father saw him coming, filled with love and compassion. He ran to his son and embraced him. That picture of God, for me, really resonated. And I have wandered off often. And when I come back, God is very consistent that he's there. I've been part of church business, big church, the corporate church, and I've seen the dark side of that. And there's a piece of that that it can become really dark. There's a shadow side to it, because you organize stuff, and anytime you organize things and own things and run things, it has an insipid piece of it, right? And so it can take us out. It took me out. When I was pastoring a church, having to raise X number of dollars a week just became a burden. And then you had to say certain things, and you had to say it within a certain paradigm. And if you didn't believe the whole paradigm, then you couldn't really sign off on the dotted line. And I couldn't. And so that cognitive dissonance became unlivable. And so I came back to the Father, and I love this last piece. I'm no longer worthy of being called your son. I felt that so often. But his father said to his servants, quick, bring the finest robe in the house, put it on him, etc. And we must celebrate with a feast, for this son of mine was dead and now has returned to life. He was lost, but now is found. And I love the last line. So the party began. And I think that this is about that. So the party begins. Like, let's get on with the party. Because when Jesus was with his disciples, he didn't say, hey guys, let's start a new religion and name it after me. He didn't say that. He said, this is about the kingdom. It's about something bigger. It's about justice. It's about love. It's about grace. And that grace awakening, right? When you awaken to that, oh, let the party begin. Because now we're in God. God's in us. And we can see each other and see all of each other and be okay with that. It's okay to come together with people that are not perfect. And it's like, as you look at each other, you know, in a moment, we're going to stand and dismiss. When you see people as you leave, here's what you need to know about all of us here, is they're not perfect. And that's awesome. Right? We've all got our dark side. We've all got our shadow side. And that's okay. And so let the party begin. And if we love each other on the basis of not kind of morality and rules, but on the basis of our brokenness, on the fact that we're loved and that we can love others, that I think fundamentally transforms how we gather. Everybody cool with that? All right, let's stand. Here's our benediction for this morning. I'm sorry, I'm 3 minutes over, so I apologize. So here's our benediction. Often we'll say in the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, stuff like that. But and today, here's our benediction. Here it is. Pull that slide. There it is. Okay, here's the benediction. Are you ready? So the party began. Have a great week. God bless you.